Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Jack Lepiarz. Tonight, we have a poetry reading presented by the Boston University Center for Interdisciplinary Teaching and Learning, College of General Studies, and Center for the Humanities. Our readers will be Northwestern University Professor Emeritus of English Paul Breslin, BU Creative Writing Program Director Carl Kirchway, and author Glenn Maxwell. We begin with an introduction by tonight's moderator, Boston University Associate Professor of Humanities, Meg Tyler.
They will read in alphabetical order, and I feel very grateful to them for coming, some from further than others, but even from down the street, my gratitude is immense that you came down here. So thank you all very much for coming. So first we'll hear from Paul Breslin, then Carl Kirchway, and then Glenn Maxwell. Thank you.
Well, I just want to say thank you to Meg for inviting me to read in this series. I am pleased and honored to do so, and to do so in the company of two very fine poets. I shall be on my mettle. I'm reading from this book, which came out at the end of November of last year, so it has a little bit of the new car smell left at this point. But I would like to preface it with one poem written since then in July. It's a three-liner. It's called A Yahrzeit Candle for Eric Garner. The flame, like all of us, survives on air. Cup it, it gutters, dies. I can't breathe, it iterates, till no breath's left to say it can't. Now to the book, which also opens, I suppose, with rather dark themes. The first poem concerns the event on September 11th, 2001, which I believe has driven the country into a kind of national insanity from which we have not recovered yet. The title of the poem is simply Zero, and it's not written out, it's the figure zero. And I think it helps to remember that shape as the opening lines are read. It is the shape of an absence with a boundary drawn around it. It is the shape of a mouth opened in astonishment or despair, and all of those connotations hold. Zero. Whole, torn in the language, how shall we speak? On the scale of war, but where are the armies? A few men and less money than houses cost on my block. Counting the dead is like counting the stones in a wall when we have no word meaning wall. Wind, acrid with toxins, makeshift shrines in the street. When Stockhausen called it art, we were outraged, and yet something art-like went into its making. Only after it happened could we imagine it, which might also be said of the Hammerklavier or the Pietà. Poem like It Alludes, Babel, Nineveh, the Tarot's Tower broken by lightning, the revelation of John of Patmos, who ends the Christian Testament by smashing the world. Our cars grow larger and heavier. People say they feel safer inside. As if we had not seen the tallest and heaviest thing we know how to make melt in the fire and fall. The next poem is much more up close and personal. I guess the book is generally concerned with forms of damage, public and private, but I don't draw the confessional poet's conclusion that those are one and the same thing, but they influence each other. They're not completely separable. So this poem is called Siren, and I'm thinking primarily of the thing on a fire engine or an ambulance, but also of those creatures who lured sailors to their deaths on the rocks, because for certain people, guilt and suffering have a kind of a siren call that has to be recognized as such and perhaps resisted, and I am one of those people, for better or worse. So this poem is called Siren. I could swear it is saying my name, a human voice full of pain and anger. It's the police come to arrest me for a crime so long concealed I forget its name. Or my father's ghost crying, he might have lived had I loved him better. It's my mother folding her arms and saying, take your anger someplace else, it doesn't belong to me. My wife asking, is this goodbye then? Or my daughter in childhood saying hoarsely through tears, Dad, how can you say that to me? So many things were almost the end. At the fire station around the corner, the engines are pulling away. So little to separate us from the one the siren is for, whose house flies into the air as cinders, who lies on his bed turning purple and clutching his heart. This next poem, I suppose, owes something to our popular culture. I may be one of the few PhDs who has watched every episode of Buffy the Vampire Slayer. And the poem is called The Vampire on Vampires. A vampire is trying to explain and defend his lot against the accusations of humans, of living people. The Vampire on Vampires. We leave no deficits in the hospital blood banks. Each night, we return to balance the books. We prize the veins of the throat, delicate bridge between heart and brain. There, through the least slit, blood leaps free in the air. The cannibal, eating the great heart of his enemy, enlarges his own, but we keep getting thinner. You envy our deathlessness, so fragile sunlight turns us to dust, less than our innocence. Once bitten, what choice but go monster? Those on your side of the coral lack our excuse. Much as you fear us, we seldom kill. The corpses keep getting up, stunned, but undead. Sterile, we reproduce from your raw material, using most tender care not to destroy you. That, O you who make blood from your own marrow and shed it for bodiless words, was never our pleasure, but yours. Okay, I'm going to do a couple of sections of a sequence of eight poems called octets. There are eight of them, and they each have eight lines, handled differently. Some are free verse, some are metrical, some are rhymed in various ways, and some not. They're all about scenes from my childhood, and here are two of them. The lanterns. I wanted the long, low-ceilinged basement rec room dark, except for the pair of brass ship's lanterns, green and red, that unmoored the room from the house and lit its path from roadstead to open water where, caught by the trades, it would embark southward as new-minted stars climbed from the sea and shoals of fish leapt, shedding concentric rings of phosphorus, to anchor after prolonged, delicious loneliness where no one who was not a child could follow me. And the last of the eight is called Stars and Dinosaurs, and it's a kind of a modification of the form. Well, in anglicized, it's the triolet. It's the triolet, I guess, in French, involving repeated lines as well as rhyme. Stars and Dinosaurs. I studied the night sky and dinosaurs in the field museum, their living shapes now stone. Fleeing with my telescope, my parents' wars, I studied the night sky and dinosaurs, remote, extinct, or the light years distant stars, were easier terrors than the nearer one I studied. The night sky and dinosaurs, dear mute companions, let me be alone. There are two poems in this book that come out of my experience of writing a critical study of Derek Walcott and coming to know him. And one of them is too long to read here, but this one is sort of based on a painting of his that I saw in New York in the, well, I don't know, 2006 or 7. So, A Street in Groseillers after a painting by Derek Walcott. A wiry boy, left arm thrown straight for balance, lugs a red bucket seawards. The street, empty except for a rooster crossing, will reach the beach three houses down. No face looks out at him from door or window. His face is turned away. But his leftward torquing torso's almost playful, as if to make of his tedious work a dance. Behind the houses on the right, trees bend their shadows left to help him counterweight the bucket's drag. At Groseillers, the sea is west. That means the sun's north of the zenith. High summer noon, the sky a wash of zinc, and a mist-fine rain likely to form by nightfall. For now, the earth's bone dry. Where is he going? The hottest hour of a hot day, when even this voluble Caribbean street is silent. What does he carry that makes him strain away from it so it won't pull him down? Water? Live bait? Nails? The island's history? Will he set it down at the last house or empty it into the sea that has so much already? I'm going to read now a poem that is sort of the heart of the book, the poem that the title comes from. It alludes in passing to a poem of Rilke's called Wendung, or Turning Point, in which Rilke says, Werk des Gesichts ist getan, tue nun Herzwerk. The work of seeing is done, now work on the images that are within you, for you do not yet know them. So that's mentioned in passing. And the title of the poem is, It Is All Down a Well. Today I bring well sweep, draw rope and bucket to clear and to lift the cleared water. Did I stare down towers? Ah, no, I went straight at hard work. The words peeled from a mildewed wall. Window, soul eye, do not deny me, though I've tunneled through like a blind mole. Earth, why has your touch spared me? I praise your corrosive mineral salts, your topsoil abrading my skin. Stand under the sun hammer of August noons. My flesh, aren't we astonished to be alive? Who kills himself kills the world also and what he has made in it. He who begot me unmade himself before I was grown. Shadow of rage and despair always between my eye and the light. Acknowledge the source that casts you. Son, you've been asked so many times to come up for nothing. You are always patient. Bear with me a little while longer.
I'd like to thank Meg for this invitation and thank all of you for coming. First, a poem from the Jersey Shore dedicated to Robert Pinsky, who grew up in Long Branch. Ocean Grove. The onshore breeze this morning arrives unopposed since Portugal and the Azores. I'm the one upright thing in the landscape. The broken tower and Moorish pleasure dome at Asbury Park are just vague shapes through the salt haze. It is written in the Upanishads that all thought ascends by means of a certain artery to that aperture in the crown of the skull by which the spirit first entered the body, then on the sun's rays to the sun itself, as warm air rises over the land, and the breakers hurl themselves up the beach and then fall back, hissing, not this time, but another time. A poem about staring out the window at the Rome airport. Fiumicino, morning. Effortlessly, the buzzard strokes the midway air, each wingtip splayed feather darkly visible, where above the concrete apron and the parched earth splashed with poppies and those flowers known as the eyebrows of Zeus, it tilts and rides the thermals. Above the runways, game board shapes of the geometer, cone and cylinder, dihedral, rhombus, delta, whose skin-deep miracles of surface sufficed for us to fly. As a blue-suited man puts his head in the mouth of an engine that has crossed an ocean, turns away and pops a Pez in his mouth. The butterfly bush is called Buddleia. Apparently, all of us of a certain age were exposed to dangerous X-rays when we were young at the Buster Brown shoe store. Buddleia. The Buster Brown shoe sizing machine may have dealt gamma rays, but how could a mother and son ever have known back in the old days? And what steps in that first pair of dress shoes led from there to here, from that store to the several monarch butterflies, their wings flame and char, that tremble now on my garden's butterfly bush, riding its violet cones, then rise by feints into the morning hush through the air's invisible obstructions. The thyroid gland, and mine was acting up, is shaped like a butterfly. So while the doctor pushed his needle deep during the biopsy, and I lay like a specimen transfixed, forbidden to swallow, breathe, or move, I thought again of the butterflies in my garden, and I wanted to live only with Buddleia and the summer weeks of its sweet smell, with butterflies, according to the Greeks, an emblem of the soul, and their erratic flickering upward. I wanted not, even if thyroid means a door-shaped shield, not yet to go through it. In India, it's said that the chipmunk's stripes are the result of the god Shiva's running his fingers down their side. November, Columbia County. The yellow-shouldered bumblebees are absolutely still, as if they were dead, on each aster's velvet head, their wings folded against the purple ray flowers. The black-eyed Susans, all dilated pupil with staring down the shortening days that can no longer load the raspberry canes with ripened fruit. Fingered by Shiva, its tail straight, a chipmunk vaults for the basement, and from the swamp, as the moon rises, the barred owl's call is merciless and rapid. My brother-in-law is an astronomer, and this poem is dedicated to him. The title refers to one of the numbered Messier objects in the night sky. The poem quotes a couple of lines from Paradise Lost, describing the Greek forge god Hephaestus falling out of heaven and landing on the Greek island of Lemnos. His wife was Aphrodite. The great Italian poet, 20th century, Salvatore Quasimodo, was criticized for ignoring the rise of fascism in Italy. M42. He is asleep now. He can do nothing by day. His card table and deck chair stand akimbo at the edge of a pasture full of snow, the barrel of his telescope rolled away, that was angled southeast, looking for news, as if the Pan-Lemnian Philanthropic Association had posted, "From morn to noon he fell, from noon to dewy eve," or arranged a winter cruise, the forge god gimping across the ballroom with his ashy face and his trophy bride. As the owl and coyote cry in the winter cold, he will tour the veil of star making, the trapezium, where hydrogen goes to helium in an incandescent hiccup. In boots, a down jacket, and fingered mittens, he will make his grand rounds of the heavens, attended by one red light as others sleep. And not lonely, never lonely, maybe a little moved by the fugitive smudge of the Lovejoy comet, or by the moon's ruined face, or Canis Major obedient and trotting forever at Orion's heel. But he would agree with Quasimodo, who says, "The poet must live in the real world, not an ideal one, so that he doesn't get hit over the head again while he watches the setting of the Pleiades." The lake described next is in a town outside Montreal where I grew up. On hearing that, its dam failing, Pine Lake will be drained. As children, we were given freedom and played all day in tribes according to the games we made up through territories elaborately guarded. Our bodies were part of this, or yielded impulsively in friendship. It was an age of heroes. We acted without thinking of how we would tell what we had done. But every path ended at the lake's edge, where we found ourselves reflected, motionless, framed by dark trees. A childless couple lived there, a fragile woman and an enormous man whom we called Tiny. They listened to our stories as water poured over the dam and fled down the spillway. They can drain the lake, for all I care. The loss was long ago. A New York Times luggage scanner photograph of a would-be immigrant at Gibraltar, curled up in the fetal position, reminded me of Randall Jarrell's famous poem, "The Death of the Ball Turret Gunner." Boy discovered in suitcase, Adu Ouattara, New York Times, May 20th, 2015. The state was already broken when I fell out of my mother's body into time. It was all mobile phones and machetes and dust. Now I am a sonogram, a shadow in a hard case, or $500 for a square meter in a rubber raft, or I slept in a wheel well 7 miles high. You put the dream there beyond the pillars of Hercules, that somewhere is a frontier porous enough so that I will not be invisible forever. There are translators to help me across. The work of art not described in the next poem is the Mona Lisa. Musée du Louvre. The room was like a mosh pit, smelling of sweat and the vomit of small children, with bodies packed in as on a subway train. The image behind its bulletproof glass was mostly ignored, flanked on either side by guards who looked uneasy, as if they had been hired instead to protect the life of Madonna or Lady Gaga, while everyone held up an electronic device, trying to take a selfie, not the work of art, but the image of it, not the self transformed in reverie, but always asserting its equivalence, proud and forlorn in time, defeating all possible insight, and the soul twisting idly in its socket, poor, broken thing working just like the shoulders of a girl who was mugging in front of a Giotto, her arms and legs outstretched, off balance, and windmilling as a winged Christ bestows the stigmata on St. Francis. This too, recorded, gone live, gone viral, beyond recall, while across the gallery, in a two-story high wedding at Cana, a young woman who has dozed off at the banquet table wakes in time to see Christ turn water into wine. The beautiful nonchalant emerges from her slumber, according to the wall label, alive for a moment in the cloud of her perishing. Ooh. Moving briskly from high culture to low culture, this poem is called Gremlin and is about watching Twilight Zone reruns. October 11th, 1963. I think I saw the premiere of this show a month before Oswald shot Kennedy when I was 7, half a century ago. I recognized William Shatner in the lead, not yet become Captain Kirk in Star Trek, playing the part of a man newly recovered from a, I didn't know what it was, nervous breakdown, who sees a gremlin on the wing of the plane carrying him and his wife home from the sanatorium. A gremlin, the thing combat pilots reported seeing if they were tired or afraid or lost. But it's just early black and white TV now, in its melodrama needing the assist of sovereign imagination, so that through prop wash and lightning, a child's oatmeal bear may stubbornly endure a violent night, intent on doing harm, clawing at the engine cover as if to extinguish the world's last spot of light. In fact, the world beyond the screen was dark. My mother bedridden with mysterious illnesses, my father out of town for work, and she would be dead in less than 10 years, taking her unappeasable grief with her, the mute appeal I hated and resisted instinctively, now given a whole life's leisure to ask myself, what was it that she wanted? A question I can't answer, just as once through wind and rain, the trembling invalid twitched back the cabin windows, curtains, chintz, as if it were to glimpse his own wife's naked body. And yet instead, what does he see? A cephalopod face squashed against the window, writhing and smeared, but also brutally curious, only wanting to get in somehow. Poor monster, evil not in what was meant, but rather in what would not conjure with the neither hostile nor benign intent of desolation seeking human warmth. The next poem has the title of A Gaudy Cocktail, very popular in Europe, and the poem quotes my stepmother, whose friend's death is described. Aperol Spritz, the poem set in Zurich. Across the river from the Grossmünster and its pepper pot towers, Charlemagne in his niche with a gold crown to wear, an iron sword across his knees, we sit in Wine Market Square drinking Aperol Spritz by the sign of the stork, watching swans pedal by on the Limmat's green-veined dark. In Switzerland, you decide when the quietus comes, when you've had enough, when what goes through you like a blade sometimes, being ordinary love, can no longer recompense the body's pain. You can exit quickly. In her arms, he drank the bitter drink. And then he died, my friend Bobby, with whom I went to the mountains every year. The black-masked swans drift by on water that is deep and clear, come from those snow mountains where the high colds, like a single indrawn breath with no more to follow, all having joined the long parade into death. Bobby wears the black mask now, and who would put it on? Who but Secret hopes he keeps it on a while? The drinks blush in our conversation's gaps, and the strict king is powerful. The last poem I'll read is called Rosciolo, and it refers to a pretty hilltop town now largely abandoned in the earthquake-prone region called the Abruzzo, east of Rome. And you all know that the Roman Catholic Church, the martyrology, all these incredibly ingenious ways in which human beings were put to death by the Romans. The female body, in particular, suffered extremely imaginative tortures. Rosciolo. Monte Velino is head in the clouds again, its grim escarpments luminous with snow above a town everyone's forgotten. B Street leads to Garden Street. I follow Oven Street to Bread Street. Archways choked with nettles, doors open onto rooms ceilinged with sky and golden walls held up by iron turnbuckles. A dog hunches and shits in the piazza, then hobbles off. A bell calls late to vespers, buzzing, indignant in the church beneath. Women chant to Lucy with her dish of eyes, Agatha's breasts, Apollonia's scattered teeth. The silence heals. There is only cloud shadow on wooded hillsides flickering across. I will live on Smile Street in Rosciolo. Perhaps it'll be my last known address. A left to get there, off Melchior Street, led by ancient Costanza and her key. As each thing to its source and appetite, and feel the gently stung calm rise in me.
When you're not here, and leaving blank the page would say so better than this patch of language, before I know myself as stuff at all, when nothing has transpired and time is still, then I'm some Adam fumbling in a wood, made for God knows what beyond the word I have for Eve. The word I have for Eve is rising to its place. The word I have is going without saying. Now more than sunlight dawns, and more than everywhere, and more than finds the path worth breath. Whatever comes of it, should the word it mean path, breath, eve, or sunlight? Should it mean what makes canvas of the dark, or of the desolation handiwork? A few months ago, I got a commission to write a review of a book about Shakespeare's sonnets. And I thought I really ought to do this, as it came from on high. I thought it was time I addressed the fact that I didn't like them very much. Well, it's not entirely true, but at least I don't like... I like the least of the plays more than them, and I wanted to figure out why, because it had kind of bemused me without me ever addressing it. Anyway, I'm not going to do that here. I gave him about 7 out of 10, I'll live with that. Anyway, but as a result of that period of time when I was reading a lot of sonnets, I wrote one. 7 Things Wrong with the Love Sonnet. Accept this old container from this old container. Seven things wrong with the love sonnet. It's planned. We weren't. It's structured to unfold in a set time. We haven't, and we shouldn't. It lets no silence in. We do, and share it. It boasts it will outlast us. Let it try it. And say it does. We'll not be here to hear it. And say it doesn't. In our rustling quiet, we shan't miss anything, so we shan't miss it. It's pondering how to end. Profoundly sod it. Sod poetry for its nodding little visit. For the time it's costing you to have to read it. For the time it took from me, it's had its say. Let it stand guard here. Say, they went that away. I was talking to some of the playwright students yesterday and thinking about how playwriting has, theatre has elbowed poetry out of the way a lot in the last few years. And I've recently been coming back to poetry and writing more, and most of what I'm reading this evening is pretty new. But a lot of them have been commissions. People have sort of commissioned them for various reasons. And this obviously was. This was commissioned by London Zoo. I got this call from a poet, Ruth Burdell, and she said, fans of Derek would have probably heard of. And she said, London Zoo are going to commission six writers to write about various endangered animals. And I said, oh, great, can I have that? And she goes, well, actually, most of them have been taken. And I'd obviously been drafted in as a replacement for someone. Ian McEwan had the panda, or J.K. Rowling had the sort of, you know, all the good ones were taken. So she said to me, Ruth, you've got to do something endangered that they have one of at London Zoo. You get a little money, it gets into the Guardian newspaper, and you get a year's subscription to the zoo, which means you can go places other people can't in the zoo. Not in the cages, but you can go nearer them or something. I don't know. I didn't try it out. But I said, actually, okay, could you do an amphibian? And I said, okay. And then she called a bit later and said, actually, could you do the Majorca midwife toad? And so the sort of field of options had definitely reduced slightly to the Majorcan midwife toad. So this is a poem I wrote to support the Majorcan midwife toad, which was endangered, isn't now, obviously. I saved it. But the thing about this is that most of what you need to know about the Majorcan midwife toad in headline terms is in the title. It's in Majorca. It'll come up in the poem. But obviously, what the poem really is, like an awful lot of poems are these days, is a homage to Wikipedia, as you'll notice almost immediately. But the one thing you do when you write, you know, you stumble on wonderful discoveries. Even though a lot of Wikipedia provides a lot of them, way too many, that more than I'm prepared to admit. But one was that the taxonomic name for creatures that were thought to be extinct and then reappear is Lazarus taxon. So any animal that's Lazarus taxon has been thought to be extinct. For example, the coelacanth, which is that big fish that was caught off the coast of South Africa after having been assumed extinct for centuries. Weirdly, the first time I read this poem, I followed on from a poet who had the coelacanth in her poem. What are the odds? Anyway, I was quite pleased since I was going to say coelacanth and had no idea how to say it. So now I know. Similes of the Majorcan midwife toad. Like the coelacanth and the rock rat of Laos and the nightcap oak and the mountain pygmy possum, we are Lazarus taxon. We are back, who were never gone. We were here, and you never knew. We thought you'd died out too. Like the lump sucker fish and the giant water bug and the seahorse and the three-spined stickleback, we have such helpful males. You make astounding tales of what's natural to our kind. but among us, kind means kind. Like the Bermuda petrel and the Formosan rock macaque and the rhinos of Java, we are endemic, so we've nowhere else to go. But the look in your eyes reveals you know how that feels. Like the toadfish and the black-capped chickadee, the beluga whale and the Mexican free-tailed bat, the Pacific chorus frog and the nightingale, the Malabar whistling thrush and the antelope squirrel, we sing. We don't know how, but hey, we are singing now. We sing for the world is new, like you, we imagine, do. In the age of pen and paper, when the page was a snow village, when days the light was leafing through, descended without message, the nib that struck from heaven was the sight of a cottage window, lit by the only certain sign of a life, a candle, glimpsed by a stranger walking at a loss through the snow village. All that can flow can follow that sighting, though no image, no face appear, not even the hand that draws across it, though the curtains close the vision, though the stranger end his visit, though the snow erase all traces of his passing through the village, though his step become unknowable, and the whiteness knowledge. I usually preface that poem by reflecting that my poetry appears to be more religious than I am, which is something I've been meditating on for quite a while now. This is a poem called "The Election," and it relates to what happened to us in the UK in May, where we had an election. And my brother and I are big sort of fans of Cephology, and ever since we were kids, we would stay up all night for election night and colour in the constituencies on a big war map. And now the technology has advanced. I was going back to my brother's house, and he had about like 7 laptops going with all the sort of possible permutations and projections on the wall, and it was wonderful. We were really looking forward to just playing the whole kind of election night coverage thing. And then as I was driving there, I stopped off in a garage and the radio was on, and there was a projection which told me what the result was going to be, and it just wasn't as much fun after that. Anyway, this may happen to you soon. I suppose it's a poem about how all those policies and principles that have in time, you know, sometimes been dressed up as Christianity or dressed up as heritage or dressed up as tradition, people increasingly in my country aren't even bothering to dress them up as anything, and they're just basically admitting we don't like strangers. We don't have pity for anyone, and it is only important to get the country's economy right, and it is only important to make money. And that started a while ago, but it just seems it's become really naked now. Anyway, that's my X on the paper. The election. It's about a fox, though, you know. Won't do that. I don't know if you have this, but we have foxes all over our cities. We never used to have them. They used to hide and so on, but now they just wander around London saying, hey, you right? Yeah. They don't, you know, don't care. Won't do that thing we do and assume the fox is grinning. Watch him break from a foul spot and saunter into limelight. My thoughts as flat as his. For any time he sets off for his needs in the night city, I and people like me stop and think the same. He didn't used to act so frigging brazen. Is this something we're doing wrong, or nothing touching us at all? You walk a curb your kindred came to grief on, not a toss gets given. Were you not scared of light one time? Did you not need a zigzag ingenuity to make the chickens walk your walk? We've literature that says you once did shy, did plausible, sweet, biddable, polite. But look at you by floodlight. Nothing you have time for but a wish list, fat and soon, the churning stomach for it, X to mark the spot. never have met me, know me well. Tell all the world there was little to tell. Say I was heavenly, say I was hell. Harry me over the blasted moors, but come my way, go yours. Never have touched me, take me apart. Trundle me through my town in a cart. Figure me out with the aid of a chart. Finally add to the feeble applause, and come my way, go yours. Never have read me, look at me now. Get why I'm doing it, don't get how. Other way round, have a rest, have a row. Have skirmishes with me, have wars. Oh, come my way, go yours. Never have left me, never come back. Mourn me in miniskirts, date me in black. Undress as I dress, when I unpack, pack. Yet pause for eternity on all fours. To come my way, go yours. Never have met me, never do. Never be mine, never even be you. Approach from a point it's impossible to, at a time you don't have. And by these bylaws, come my way, go yours. So the Globe Theatre has a new, the Globe is a replica of the original Globe on the Bankside in London, and they've recently opened a replica of the first indoor theatres as well, which is, if you've seen it, it's a glorious little black box space that's entirely candlelit, called the Wanamaker Theatre, after Sam Wanamaker, the American director who initiated the whole Globe in London thing. So the Wanamaker Theatre at the Globe invited various poets to come and write responses to four major religious poets, Herbert, Donne, Blake, and Hopkins. And these are two of the ones I did. This is a response to the Herbert poem Affliction. It's written in the same form, in fact. Herbert was a profoundly religious man, and his poem Affliction is to be very short and crude about it, is about recklessness of youth giving way to sort of sadness and gravity of age in terms of, you know, in terms of returning to God and so on. So what I've tried to do with this is something that's about the sort of recklessness of a young poet who feels they can write anything about anything, and how that sort of develops over time, or it evolves, or, I don't know, is eroded by the presence of the white space, the silence, the nothing. I've been meditating on silence and white space a lot, but I didn't think that would really get your hearts racing, so I didn't say that at the beginning. But I have been thinking about that a lot lately, and so this is called The White, and it's about that sort of journey. But it's really for poets. It's not I'm not really a believer. I'm an agnostic at best. But it's really about the journey. The White. When you first made a sound, you made a sound on nothing. Not on peace, on nothing. Not on silence, nor the grand absence of what was. On nothing. And it hadn't got that name, nor any name. It looked like what's to come and has gone now. That sweep of white. And white was just a term for it. Not a thing to notice, that polite attendant at the gate. With nothing to examine but a list, clocking and ticking all who simply passed by now without a word. What kind of fool can't make his mark on white? When you first made a sound, you could make all the sounds there are, could write the moment in the moment, at the pace it passes you, when you don't hear it pass. Until you do, you saw that stanza break. And now it dawns on you, you're in a fight with something. What you make is making something too, and it's something you don't mean. The gaps, the blanks are everywhere, and vague oblivion blinks whichever room you enter. Shrug it off, there's nothing there. It's white, it doesn't speak, is nothing to speak of, nothing compared to what you have to say, have come to say, have left to say. It seems you thought your gift a gift, but look what's walking with it. Each line ending turns your head. It's nothing. The wind, perhaps. Crack on with what you're saying. But all you hear is breathing. You hide in other voices, so the space will come for them and leave you be. But these, it doesn't want, your works, your make-believe. These edge away, immune, to far away, and once upon, said, safe. They are leaving you alone, like beloved actors will. Now white is dark and audible from here. To do your work is to defer it, though you hurtle there on its cold fuel. To cry against it is to sound its orchestra, and the opposite, to cry, will bring it in white gloves and epaulettes to say, there, there, and dab your eyes to bits. And you can't shake it off. It's now the cold, the soon, the gone, the neither. It strolls with you, your wrist is lightly held, your breath depends, forever streams beside you like the only river, and what they make you gingerly step over, you don't recall. When you next make a sound, you strike a match in darkness. See, all that grows is growing all around, and all you wrote was helpless as a witness. If the white did this to you, all this it made of you, or made you do, what is its name? Who was it? Who lives here? To which that same benign attendant blankly smiles at the screen door. And if you wish to sign her leather-bound great crimson book, just do, for no one's asking you or stopping you. Thank you so much for coming. I think the older you get, your respect for audience turns to sort of just profound love after a while, for anyone who comes to poetry readings, you know. I mean it. Thank you.
This is Boston University's World of Ideas. You've just heard a poetry reading presented by the Boston University Center for Interdisciplinary Teaching and Learning, College of General Studies, and Center for the Humanities. Our readers were Northwestern University Professor Emeritus of English Paul Breslin, BU Creative Writing Program Director Carl Kirchway, and author Glenn Maxwell. Tonight's moderator was Boston University Associate Professor of Humanities Meg Tyler. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. You may also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda and Michael Garth, with help from Ian McCarn. The executive producer of Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydonis. I'm Jack Lepiarz. Thanks for joining us.